Well, good morning, Church by the Sea. It's so good to be with you this morning, and I just want to remind you, a phrase that I keep hearing over and over has become this phrase, uncertain times. We find ourselves in these uncertain times, and I just want to pause and remind all of us that all of this is known and seen and finished, that God, from this place of eternity, has declared the victory. That we can rest in that fact, even though we find ourselves in this place, this point of time, watching our future unfold. We can rest in the promises and victory of a God who knows all things from the beginning to the end. Well, this last week, I spent this week teaching. I've been doing this for the last few years, working with a spiritual formation program, and this week was on Zoom. And so basically, I've spent this whole week in front of a computer screen. And I was thinking, one of the odd things about Zoom and teaching on Zoom is that my face is there. It's like having a mirror up in front of yourself when you teach. And so most of the time when I'm speaking to you, I'm not actually seeing myself or looking at myself. But all week long, that sort of reality is there on a Zoom call, is just this image of myself staring back at me in a mirrored reflection as I teach. And so I'm constantly like noticing myself or seeing myself, or like more what feels like self-aware of my image. And thinking about how this odd sort of reality that all I've ever seen of myself is simply my reflection, that I've never actually seen my face. I've just seen an image of my face. That my perception of myself is always a sort of interpretive image of myself. I was thinking about this fact that when we see ourselves in a mirror, did you know that it's always, our face is always half the size of our actual face? That this is just a simple little physics equation. But if you were to go to a mirror that's steamed up and draw a circle around your face and measure it, it's exactly half. Which means that I've always seen a sort of smaller image of myself than is really there. And I think there's kind of an analogy for us, that the fact is all we really know of ourselves is a perception of ourself. 1 Corinthians 13:12 says, "For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known." And I love that verse because it reminds me that certainly while I don't have things figured out, while I am always interpreting, God is not. God knows my heart. He knows who I am better than I know or may ever know myself. But we have this heart that God longs for us to know. That our intents and purposes, the depth of who we are, is like deep water. And in Proverbs, it says, "The purpose in a man's heart is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out." But we're told in the New Testament that we have the Spirit dwelling within us who searches our hearts, who longs to bring that knowledge to the forefront, because in that knowledge is the opportunity for transformation. The work that God is doing is happening in these deep waters of our heart. And it's a work we participate in with God. But part of that is simply the willingness to let God draw these things about us into the light where they can heal and be restored. Dallas Willard says, "The heart is the executive center of the self and our likeness to God, being in his image. Our will refers to that component's power to initiate and create. Heart is not feelings, but refers to its being the center or core of the human being, the part to which every other component of the self owes its proper functioning." Our heart and our will, I think, are really one and the same. It's our chooser. It's from which the actions in our life are birthed. And I love how it's saying it's our creative center. And our words and our actions reveal this heart. I like how in Luke 6:45 it says, "The good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil. For out of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaks. Which should feel a little convicting. Those angry outbursts or reactions that come out of us. Behaviors that reveal a sort of selfishness or self-righteousness, words of judgment, words of criticism, words of blame. All of this point to the depths of our heart. And Proverbs tells us the wise person wades into there and searches those depths. That we are, all of us, deep oceans. But to dive down rather than stay on the surface is where we as disciples of Christ are meant to go. That we join in the Spirit's work as we plumb the depths of our hearts. What we study every Sunday when we come to church is this way of wisdom, which we would say is the way of abundant life. It's more than just healing. It's learning to thrive. It's more than just how do we achieve success in life, but how do we live lives of deep meaning and glory? More than this pursuit simply of happiness is the pursuit of joy. And these things come, the true rewards come as our hearts change. And the gift of a time of uncertainty or times of suffering, where we move into unfamiliar territory, as we find ourselves oftentimes seeing our hearts peeled back a bit more. And that this is an invitation and a gift for us. Because all of us deep down crave truth, but settle for superficial truths. You've heard it said that there are no atheists in a foxhole. And I think what we want is wisdom that remains true in that foxhole, perceptions of reality that remain true in those places where we're afraid or anxious. Truths that have that sort of depth, not pithy phrases, but things that cut life at its joints, that get down to the depths. This kind of wisdom isn't found just simply in platitudes. It comes like from the gut. One of my favorite songs is a song called Times Like These, which was written by Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters. And he wrote this song. One of the things I love about it was written at a deep low point. A time where he would say he didn't know who he was, and in a hotel room he scratched the lyrics to this song. And the chorus of it, to me, is sung with such depth. He says, it's times like these you learn to live again. It's times like these you give and give again. It's times like these you learn to love again. It's times like these, time and time again. And as he sings that last line, you feel the sort of lament underneath his words. Because we come through times like these, and yet we find ourselves going back in times like these. And the hope is that we're changed, we learn to love, we rediscover who we were, but we also are transformed into something more. And so often in life, we find ourselves going back into these places of learning and relearning and relearning. Our psalm today is written by a philosopher. His name's Solomon, and his dad wrote most of the psalms. We know Solomon for the deep, proverbial wisdom that he writes in the book of Proverbs. We don't often think of Solomon as a songwriter, but here we see Solomon penning the words to one of the psalms of ascent. And I wonder if for him, these words had that sort of gut reaction where it wasn't enough to just jot them down, but instead, these were words, this is wisdom that had to be sung. Words that came from the gut. Let me read our song for us today, Psalm 127, Unless the Lord Builds the House. Solomon writes, Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil. For he gives sleep, he gives to his beloved sleep. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. And this word vanity is repeated three times there in the beginning of this. And our psalmist, Solomon, knows something of vanity. He doesn't just write Proverbs, but probably was the writer of Ecclesiastes as well, a book filled with the warning of a life lived in vain. That the accumulation of all the things that we so often strive for end up being like sand, ultimately unsatisfied, even futile. That the accumulation of those things is a recipe for a life of regret. And Solomon knew this firsthand. I think that book is filled with such a sadness and despair underneath it, even though I think he arrives at something profound. He starts by saying there's no remembrance of people of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. Can you imagine that as a commencement speech for our senior class? Just so you know, nobody's going to remember you. But it's a sort of truth, like if that's what we're after, if that's what we're seeking to attain, then in the end, time moves on and all of us will be forgotten. And yet Solomon, by the end, is weighing this reality that obedience becomes the answer. He says, here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. And I think this reality undergirds the warning that's in this psalm. If God doesn't build the house, your labor is in vain. It's interesting, this idea of building was a metaphor that kind of links David to Solomon, that David longed to build God a temple. And it looked like, coming from Nathan, that was going to be David's assignment. And then yet, God stepped in at a certain point and said, no, there is too much blood on your hands. And so the responsibility went not to David, but to his son, which I imagine for David was deeply disappointing, heartbreaking even. And yet we find in one of David's finer moments a heart that sings God's praises even in that. That maybe even in that disappointment comes a sort of freedom for David, an attachment that he had to that sort of success that God then passed on to his child, would pass on to the one writing this song. And Solomon knew something about building as well and built God a palace, but then followed it up by building himself an even bigger one. This idea of building, constructing a temple, I think undergirds this psalm, a dwelling place for God. That in fact, this is the work that God is doing in each one of our hearts. That the heart work is like constructing a temple in which God intends to dwell, but that we have a say in the matter, that we become co-laborers with God in this work. But the question becomes, according to whose blueprint? And this is the warning of Solomon, is not that we aren't contributing our part, but that we are, in our independence, constructing something very different than God intends to build. The question that we are being asked, and all of us are being asking this, is according to whose purposes are you building your life? And this opportunity for us to take a look into our own hearts and ask ourselves this question, this is where the gold in this psalm comes from. In his book, Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis says, imagine yourself as a living house, God comes in to rebuild that house. At first, perhaps you can understand what he's doing. He's getting the drains right, stopping the leaks in the roof and so on. You knew that those jobs needed doing, and so you're not surprised. But presently, he starts knocking the house about in a way that hurts abominably and does not seem to make any sense. What on earth is he up to? The explanation is that he is building quite a different house from the one you thought of, throwing out a new wing here, putting on an extra floor there, running up towers, making courtyards. You thought you were being made into a decent little cottage, but he's building a palace. He intends to come and live in it himself. I want to ask you, have you ever felt that sort of disruption? This happens to me from time to time where I think we've finished that room, it's done, and then all of a sudden a wrecking ball comes through. I think all of us are probably feeling like that. Like, when can we go back to the way it was? Like, we were feeling pretty secure and done. I think our world got a wrecking ball coming through it. And we find ourselves going, I don't get it. Okay, God, what are you doing right now? And God's response in these moments of disruption so often is, trust me. Trust me. I know what I'm doing. Let me build the house. And I love the promise that's in here, that God is a builder. The image of God somehow like sitting back watching our lives from a distance is completely false. We have a God who is actively at work in our hearts every single day. Not only do we have God's Spirit searching our hearts, helping us discover the depths, but we have a God who is creating circumstance around us that lend ourselves to understanding, that create in us discernment, that ultimately that what we would know is not just our heart, but the heart of God. Ephesians 2, 19 through 22 says, so then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, built on a foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole structure being joined together grows into a holy temple in the Lord. In him you also are being built together into a dwelling place for God by the Spirit. That's you and that's us. That Jesus is the cornerstone. He's the one who holds all in alignment. And that we have this opportunity to build our lives on this steady foundation. Two Psalms ago, we saw that the life that is built in that place of trust is like a Mount Zion, unmovable. What we saw last week is that mountain, while it is moving, is held in that place of security by a deep sense of gratitude for what God has done, and a hopefulness that God will do it again, and that we can live in this place and sow seeds of hope and righteousness. And this bit of wisdom that Solomon is writing for us, again, it's identifying this independence in us. It's not encouraging us to just kick back, like, hey, you've been trying to build a house and God just wants you to chill. It's not saying that at all. It's not permission to be lazy and just take a nap. It's saying, no, bring your heart and your efforts and your earnestness into alignment with God's plan. Make that your template of your life. Start that every single day with the intention to be living in obedience. I think for most of us, this probably isn't even on our radar. If we just jump straight out of bed, or even worse, like pick up our phone in bed and go straight to what lays ahead of us this day, if we let the news or we let our email or if we let the urgency of the day sort of dictate our to-do list, chances are we're going to lose sight of God's blueprint. We're going to live our life reacting. And then our other desires and passions might take over. And in our sort of self-centeredness, we find ourselves building the wrong kind of dwelling. Solomon warns us, this is vanity. It's the way of regret. We build a life of achievement that in the end has no substance. And so even in this, as we see this image of somebody having difficulty sleeping, if you go back to our text, it's in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. We see the texture there, I think, of abundant life, that there's a relaxation to it, a restfulness and a peacefulness. That if we're not in that place of obedience, that our life is a life of anxious toil, wondering if we're doing enough, wondering if we've achieved enough, always pursuing that carrot that's just out of reach. God is asking us to join him in building the temple of our heart as a palace and dwelling. And when I set those blueprints according to my expectations, it's always smaller, it's always safer, it's always a place where I have more control. It also conveniently avoids closets I'd rather God not go into, drawers I would not have him open. I stay into the rooms that feel finished and done to me. And God is saying, no, part of this process is you got to let me go into those places of your life that you would prefer I didn't. Why? Well, as painful as it might be to let God in, what it creates in my life is more space, more room, more rest. There's a sort of nervous anxiety that comes when you shut those closets off as if we've dealt with those things, when in fact the reality of them is still constantly creating tension in my life. Similarly, God is saying, let me come in and refurbish this, repair this, replace this. We've, during quarantine, created this back patio space. Patty really has done it, but it's become such a restful space. Now I look at it and think, how did we do without this? But when it felt cluttered, it was easy to ignore. And this is part of what God is doing in our lives, is he's creating space. He's making us more generous. He's creating a more hospitable space, not just for himself, but for others. And the metaphor switches here. It's almost like a second psalm gets interjected. All of a sudden, now he's talking about family. He goes from this place of restfulness into talking about children, that they're a heritage, they're a reward. And the word reward there is not talking about, well, we've done something good, so God blesses you with a child. No, it's saying that children themselves are a gift. And I love that idea because I think so often for us, we see children as a possession. It's my child. But I feel a sense of ownership. And some of that is good, right? That there's a natural sort of love and affection for our own biological children. That's a beautiful thing. But what we realize as parents so often is that we are sort of entrusted with these children, even for a season of life, as we find ourselves launching one out into the world this year. And I was saying to my friends, it's like, it's weird to see myself coming to the end of an assignment with my son, and they're like, oh, he'll be back, which I'm sure is true. But the fact of the matter is that all of us with these children are entrusted with this soul, entrusted with this life. That it's a gift. And so really this idea of adoption, you know, as we've done children's blessings and had the pleasure of blessing these families that are adopting children. And really, I think it's become a template for me for every single blessing that we give of the children. The responsibility that a life is being entrusted to us for a season. And that our goal with these children is not to keep them in our home like some furniture or possession, but instead to launch them out. So we get this picture of arrows being shot, which is, it's kind of a violent metaphor if you think about it in the sort of going to battle, but what we understand is the gospel unfolds, is that we do this battle by stepping forward in peace, The battle is won by turning the other cheek. The victory is accomplished by Christ on the cross. And so we send out these arrows of peace into the world. That these are entrusted to us for a purpose of going out and changing the world. This is the battle that we take on. This is the role of the church, that not only are we a dwelling for God, but we are his instrument to bring peace and reconciliation and good news and salvation to the world. And so each one of us is invited to see our life like an arrow being shot. Each one of us has been invested in, and each one of us has the opportunity to invest in others. As we talked about last week, sowing these seeds, all of us have been sown into, and all of us now get to sow. And those seeds take a long time to bloom, and sometimes we don't even see the fruit. My dad tells a story of when he was a kid, his Sunday school teacher, because his parents were not believers, he would get picked up by his Sunday school teacher. And my dad always tells this story because he says his teacher had only one arm and could drive. And I don't know how he would do with a stick shift and drive, but anyways, sounds a little bit dangerous now. But the point is, my dad tells this story about this man. And I think, I'm so excited to meet him, because the truth is, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if it wasn't for that man sowing that seed of the gospel in my dad when he was a little boy. And this becomes kind of the image for us. It's not just talking about our immediate families. It's saying, no, all of us are investing in this greater family. All of us are being encouraged to see a kinship with all of mankind. And all of us have the opportunity to invest and to see this heritage. Every relationship put in your life is an opportunity to sow seeds. I remember a man who poured into my life when I was at the church I was at before this, years and years ago, who was this guy that was so behind the scenes. And yet when I went to his memorial service, it was filled with pastors. And I was thinking, each one of these guys represents a whole congregation. To think of the brilliance of this person stepping in with intentionality to the work that God had done, the strategic battle plan of the gospel to sow these seeds that will then produce seeds that will then be planted by more. This is the gift of this. This is what God is building. This is the story God is inviting us into. And it takes humility. Because it's not about you standing front and center. It's not about you getting the recognition you think you deserve. It's not about you getting the accolades that you so desperately might want. So God's story is a diminishing, and yet it always asks us for more. More courage. More generosity. And God does this work in our hearts to create the space that we might love more. That God enlarges our hearts, and it lets us run in his way. Matthew 7:24-27 says, "Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house. But it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand, and the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it." And God is not just building us into a house. Not only is he creating a space for him to dwell, but he himself is the foundation if we walk in obedience. And so my question for you, I have three. The first one is, are you listening? This isn't a one-time commitment. This is daily. This needs to be one of your have-tos each day. You begin your day by listening and saying, God, what is the plan? By giving ourselves that awareness, by asking ourselves the question, gives us the eyes to see as we go through the day, what is the assignment? We need to be listening right now. As we talk about issues of even racial reconciliation, listen. We want to come in with opinions. We want to come in with statements, but listen. As we parent our children, listen. Listen to their hearts. So often we speak too quickly. Listen to God's voice first. And then in empathy, listen to the voices of others. Number two, what are the rains and floods hitting your home right now? I'm sure there are multiple. It feels a bit like a perfect storm right now. But God is not surprised. God is not unaware. God is with you. Sometimes we forget that in anxiety. Our worlds shrink. But if we see those with intentionality and we see those as God's opportunity to peel back our hearts and see beneath the surface, what is God showing you? What needs to be repaired? What is God working on? Realize that God is always more concerned about your heart than the circumstance around you. And number three, who has God placed in your life to sow into? Are there things in your heart that are resisting this work? And what might you need to let go of in order to have more room to invest your life in others? So often for me, I find myself clinging to things. And that is the very definition of idolatry. Attachments that God breaks me of. You think of David with his desire to build the temple and God saying, I want you to let that go. Moses out of his desire to reach the promised land and God says, hold it with an open hand. And in that disappointment, as God says, trust me, what we realize in all of this is those things that we clutch to are too small. What we long for is something much bigger and something only God can give. I read this from Eugene Peterson. He says, the joy that develops in the Christian way of discipleship is an overflow of spirits that comes from feeling good, not about yourself, but about God. The joy comes not from feeling good about yourself, but about God. That simple little phrase has just been rattling around in my mind, convicting me so deeply because so much of my prayer is, God, let me feel good about Jeff. And God is saying, I want you to feel good about me, to know my heart, because in that is the place of intimacy where God gives rest to his beloved, sleep to his beloved. Ephesians 2:10 says, we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Let us as a church walk into these good works. Let us lay aside the desires for comfort and security and control and success. Let that be replaced by eternal meaning and glory and freedom. This week, I want to encourage you, be listening. How might God be inviting you into larger and more spacious life? Listen and then obey. Respond. Let this not be just information that you hear, but something that you put into practice. In fact, this week at Deeper Walk, I'll be asking you, how did you do? How have you been listening? And have you been obeying? Because we need to practice this so that our hearts will change, so that we can step in to the assignment we've been given to be the temple together of God, his dwelling place in this world. And with that, we would step into our vocation of planting seeds of truth and goodness and beauty in this world. Amen.